Good morning. So when Beth and I first got to Riley Hospital with Anna, we had a lot of hope and a lot of encouragement that we were being transitioned to a place that was going to be able to help. It's a beautiful facility. You walk in and everything seemed great, but there was one thing that caught me off guard. And that was when you go into Riley's Children's Hospital, there is a X-ray station and a full metal detector. And I have been in a lot of hospitals, like most pastors. I've been in a lot of hospitals. But this was the first time that it resembled the TSA getting ready to get on an airplane. And I told Beth, I said, why in the world would they need this level of security at a hospital? At a children's hospital. Again, we were optimistic and we were hopeful. Those first days, I wondered every time I came in, why? This seems unnecessary as they x-rayed my backpack and laptop as they wanded me and sent me through the metal detector gate. But we ended up, as many of you have heard, having a really bad doctor, and we ended up having a really complicated daughter. And a bad doctor and a complicated daughter, they don't go well together, especially not in a hospital. And as we had this, in our perspective, toxic brew of arrogance and apathy and incompetence from the doctor, leading to just catastrophic misdiagnosis and mistreatment, it culminated with the doctor looking me in the eye and saying, I don't care what your daughter's allergic to, I'll give her whatever medicines I want. I had the entire legal team from Riley beg me not to sue them, even though I never threatened it, because things were going that bad. My daughter was getting worse and worse. It was terrifying for Beth and I. Terrifying. And as things began to come to a head, we realized that she wasn't well enough and every day getting worse to go home. But because we were in the middle of this COVID pandemic, no other hospital would take her, and we felt trapped. And as a dad, I began to feel desperate. I know Dean and Jerry and others got some of those phone calls from me where my voice was hoarse from just screaming at the windshield. It's in that moment that I began to understand why there were metal detectors and X-ray machines on the way into the hospital. Because my heart was broken and my anger was real. But don't get me wrong, I consider myself a peaceful person. But make no mistake, in those dark moments, there was hatred in my heart. It was hatred. Just this week, we saw in the news how that darkness can lead to some really dark places. On Wednesday, we all mourned when we saw the news from Tulsa, Oklahoma, a shooting that took, I believe, four lives. An angry patient, in his own mind, had a botched surgery, was in tremendous pain, and for whatever reason, not only blamed his surgeon, but felt like he wasn't being heard. He walked into that clinic. And he shot, in his own words, in his own note, that doctor and anyone who got in his way. See, I can look at that and I can say, wow, there's a big difference between having that hatred and that anger in your heart and being the person who walks into the hospital with the gun. But as Jesus shares in the Sermon on the Mount, as I'm confronted with the text in the same way that the Pharisees and the other first century listeners would be, Jesus gives very little distinction between that anger in the heart, that hatred, that malice, and the act itself. And if that feels surprising to you today, it would have been equally surprising to the listeners in the first century. We spent some weeks in the Sermon on the Mount. And Jesus is doing something very important here for us and for the Pharisees in the audience. As we remember, it began with the Beatitudes, and much like the great commandment, love God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself, summarizes the rest of the Ten Commandments. You can't violate that, and if you violate the Ten Commandments, you violated the great commandment. So those are all specifics about how we love God and love others. Well, the Beatitudes we see are this preamble. It's this introduction to what Jesus now is bringing out in depth. And the Pharisees were equally surprised to hear that the first Beatitude was that we were to be poor in spirit, that we were to have this humility and this poverty to realize that we had nothing good to bring God. And then as we mourn that poverty, we will be comforted. And it goes on. But how do we do that? Jesus here says before this in our message last week that He is the fulfillment of all of the law. Those we like and those we don't. We talked about how part of it's in the sacrificial system and part of it is in the fact that we have this new covenant in Jesus. But part of it is in the fact that He is this greater righteousness that we're led to. And Jesus says, "For I tell you, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven." Well, as we begin verse 21, we see that Jesus is now sharing what is this greater righteousness. He's moving beyond just things that we can kind of grit our way through as the Pharisees did. The Pharisees were your type A personality folks, the ones that loved the rules, loved regulations. They were fantastic bureaucrats. They were good at it. They were good at doing things they didn't like, things they were uncomfortable with, and they were proud of themselves for being able to. But Jesus is saying that's not enough. That righteousness is not enough. And He begins to talk about a greater righteousness by hitting the Pharisees right where they were. In verse 21, "You have heard that it was said to people long ago, 'You shall not murder,' and 'Anyone who murders will be subject to judgment.' But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or a sister will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to his brother, 'Raca,'" and you can think of that as like their really good big four-letter word. I mean, this was a real bad curse to say to somebody. "Says to his brother or sister, 'Raca, I just swore in church a second time. Oh no.' Is answerable to the court. And anyone who says, 'You fool,' will be in danger of the fire of hell." See, the Pharisees were not immune to anger. They may have been kind of the angrier people because all of us know some type A folks. And would you like the world to be perfectly organized? You're angry a lot because the world is full of disorder. We see the anger of the Pharisees in that they hated Rome. They did. They couldn't stand it, and they were under Roman occupation. We see the anger of the Pharisees in the fact that they end up being angry enough with Jesus and His teaching. They see Jesus heal a sick man, and all they think of is, it's time to kill this guy. He makes the blind see again, and they're picking up rocks, and they're like, is it time to throw him now? Jesus made them very angry, and Jesus knows this. In fact, Jesus' previous statement helped prepare them to understand and probably has a lot to do with why He started with anger and murder. Because again, in verse 20, the previous verse, Jesus says, "For I tell you," and these are Pharisees that feel pretty darn good about themselves. They're here listening to Jesus, and Jesus says that, "I have not come to abolish the law, but to fulfill the law." And they're like, okay, great. He loves the law, and He loves the prophets, and we like that. But they still don't know quite what to do with them. And then Jesus says this, "For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, then you certainly will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Pharisees are hearing, what? Well, we're the good guys. We're the ones that follow the rules. We're the ones that keep the religious system moving. We're the leaders in the church. And you're saying unless their righteousness is better than ours? What does that mean? Does that mean that we're going to hell? Does that mean that we're not a part of the kingdom of God? Immediately they begin to hear this, and I'm sure they got frustrated and they got angry and they didn't quite know what to do with it. And that's exactly what Jesus wanted. He was confronting in that very passage the anger that they were feeling, the anger that would lead them to crucify Jesus. Now, much like today, if I were a Pharisee and I were to share my story about Riley's, and I did with some friends and some pastors, I heard a lot of things like, well, Jeff, don't be too hard on yourself. As I went to confess the sin of this anger that I had, they said, well, Jeff, that's a righteous anger. It's not fair to beat yourself up. And I'm sure the Pharisees did this to each other a lot too. But the truth is that Jesus here is saying that spiritually, there is little difference between wanting to murder someone, between having hatred and malice in your heart, and the very act itself. And in no way does that diminish the act, but it does elevate the anger. We give ourselves a pass because we're just angry. We're just frustrated. But Jesus, in recontextualizing this and helping us to understand that the heart matters as much as the action, that our motives matter as much as the outcome, he's helping us realize that our righteousness is not righteous enough unless we hide ourselves in Jesus. He's helping us understand that even the most righteous among us are spiritually poor. That we all need Jesus. We used the illustration last week. It's like, you know, I could be really good at jumping high. It could be Michael Jordan, his airness. Maybe today they'd say LeBron James or somebody else. But that sounds fine and good. And again, they get paid a lot of money because they can jump high and they can put a basketball in a hoop. But ask them to jump to the moon, and it doesn't look like they can jump a whole lot further than I can. And that's the same thing with the righteousness. I may not be able to jump more than a couple inches off the ground, and they may be able to jump 18 inches off the ground. But in comparison to the moon, doesn't really matter. It's all pretty poor. That's what we're seeing here. A couple things that I want to really pinpoint on. And the first one is that we characterize sin a lot more than God does. We like to say these are the really bad sins and these are the not so bad sins. But to God, sin is sin. And there are a few places that we see some distinctions here. But again, we tend to separate it out a lot more than he does. And one example of this, I love doing this in youth ministry or when I'm teaching teens. I'll take them through some of the lists of sin in the scriptures. And there's different lists, and so this is kind of a common example, but there's multiple ones that do this. And you'll be reading through the list and it says, you know, it's talking about adulterers and murderers and those who are disobedient to their parents. And the kids are like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, that doesn't fit in the list of adultery and murder and all of the other bad stuff. I'm like, no, disobedient to your parents is right in there. And they're like, whoa, whoa. It's a surprise. But Jesus and God, they don't separate, well, these sins are like worth 10 points and these are worth 5 points. 13 Hail Marys, it's all going to be fine. That's not how it works. Sin is sin. And it's all a burden upon our soul. It all needs to be forgiven by Jesus. The second thing that we see is that the Pharisees, like so many other religious teachers, throughout history. The Pharisees undervalue the desires of their heart. In fact, in a lot of religious settings, there are brownie points given to going against your desires. Even Mahatma Gandhi, who's celebrated a lot, he had his struggles where he would do things that today we would find really creepy, and I'm not going to go into them. But he'd put himself in these compromising, temptation-laden situations, and he wanted to see if his willpower was strong enough not to sin. And again, he was following a different faith in Hinduism, but still, there were moral things that were very similar to what we would find moral. And throughout history, there's this idea that the best, the most religious are those that have this strong willpower and can be put in these positions and yet not sin. So the anger could burn, and maybe you'd even put a weapon in front of them, but they'd never pick it up no matter how much they wanted to. That was the idea, especially with the Pharisees, of what made you religious, of what made you a good person. And Jesus is saying, no, I want to transform the desires of your heart. When we look at a greater righteousness than the Pharisees, what we're talking about is how the Holy Spirit can transform us. And now it's not this idea of having tremendous willpower. Most of us would be in real trouble. It's about the fact that God transforms our heart, and now we want what He wants. We want to forgive the person that hurt us, even though that's hard. We want to love our neighbor. We want to be truthful. But the idea of adultery breaks our heart. See, it's about the desire changing, because there are two very distinct ways to see this. There's our heart wants other things than what God wants, and we just have to have this steely, strong discipline to keep ourselves from sin. That form of religion will become corrupt and broken. It will burn you out. It will chew you up. It'll spit you out. You can't do it. We're not built for that. A few of us can pretend for a little while, but it's why the church becomes filled with scandals. Because God didn't design us to just resist desires all the time. He designed us to be transformed so that our desires would be His desires. See, that's the greater righteousness, is because when Jesus comes in, when we have His Spirit in our lives, our desires are transformed. Our motives change. It's not about living this terribly difficult life resisting sin. It's about loving God and loving others and loving the outcome as we follow Him. Then we get where Jesus kind of downshifts a little bit. He talks about how bad it is for us to have this hatred against our brother and sister. And then He says, therefore, in verse 23, if you were offering your gift at the altar and there remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to them, then come and offer your gift. I'm going to confess another thing here, and that is that I've long read this passage wrong. At least I've remembered it wrong. I always used to think or remember that what Jesus was saying here is that if my brother has sinned against me, if he's offended me, I need to go and reconcile to my brother before I go to the altar and worship, before I bring my gift, before I bring my worship and praise. And that's a true statement, but it's not what Jesus is saying here. Jesus is taking it a step further. You see, that I have control over. That's expected. Because hatred of my brother, that's sin. Sin akin to murder. What Jesus is saying here is if you know your brother has bitterness or anger against you, leave your gift aside and go and be reconciled to your brother. Well, Pastor Jeff, I hear that, but I don't have control over what Jimmy or Johnny or Bobby thinks of me. So they can be mad at me, but it's not my fault. I didn't do anything wrong. I don't think that matters here. Jesus is saying that if we have bitterness or unforgiveness in our heart and we go and reconcile it, that's obedience. That's expected. But that if we know that our brother or sister has something against us, even if we don't believe we're in the wrong, even if we think we've done nothing wrong, if we go and leave our gift at the altar, if we go to them to be reconciled, if we ask for their forgiveness, if we seek common ground and understanding, even when we know this isn't our problem, that's an act of worship. Jesus is saying, don't worship me at the altar when you can worship me in this experience first, because we can save a brother or a sister from destruction. And I can't tell you how many times I've seen bitterness and brokenness in relationships inside the church. And I'm not just talking about this church. I'm talking about other churches. I'm talking about in the Christian family. And too often there's one person waiting on the other end. Oh, I'd forgive them, but they better ask for it. Well, again, if you're there, you can control your own heart. But it's an act of worship for us to humble ourselves and go to our brother and say, I know you're mad at me. I don't understand why. But how can we be reconciled? How can forgiveness happen? And Jesus says, that's an act of worship. Then come back. Then make your sacrifice. Then present your gifts. But do that first. When I pastored in Ohio, I had a couple in the church that I didn't dislike, at least not at first. They were frustrating. They had a very different view of faith and practice and church than I did. In fact, many of their views were just contrary to the Scriptures. And we butt heads a lot. And I had to pull them away from leadership, and I had to have hard conversations, and it turned out that they didn't like me very much. And I tried and I tried and I tried, but when I knew that I was leaving the church and I told some leaders that I was going to be going to another church, the leaders asked me again. They said, Jeff, can you try one more time and bring reconciliation? And I said, I will. Absolutely, I'd love to. And I sat down at that meal and I asked them to eyeball to eyeball, I said, you know, what can I do? Is there anything that I can do so that our relationship can be reconciled, so that there can be forgiveness? And the husband looks me in the eye across the table and he says, you can die. It's a hard moment. And I had no bitterness in my heart. But I was doing everything that I could, trying to be faithful here. So today you may have no one that you feel like you need to forgive, and that's great. Maybe you have people you feel like you need to forgive because it's a tough life out there. But who needs to forgive you? Who have you hurt, or who's mad at you that you haven't hurt? It can be an act of worship to go and say, is there anything I can do? I've had times we've had that conversation and it went beautifully well. And again, I've had times we've had that conversation and they said, you can die. So I can't promise you that it will go well. But the act of making the effort, the act of trying, the act of going to your brother, it is tremendously powerful and healing. And if that reconciliation can bring them back to the altar of worship, make God so happy. And finally, we see that we are called to settle conflict before escalation. Matthew chapter 5, verse 25 and 26. Settle matters quickly with your adversary who is taking you to court. Do it while you are still together on the way, or your adversary may hand you over to the judge, and the judge may hand you over to the officer, and you may be thrown into prison. Truly, I tell you, you will not get out until you have paid the last penny. Now, the legal language here may throw us, because very few of us are trying to take anybody to court. But the principle here remains the same. And it's amazing how quickly things can escalate among friends. I hate to even bring this up, but I know many of you watched it on the news. A very controversial, very public, very popular trial concluded this week. It was Johnny Depp and Amber Heard. And while I could care less, all I could do, anywhere I go, people were talking about it. I was in public on Wednesday, and when the alert came out, everybody was murmuring with it. But what I think is important to understand is that while those two clearly hated one another, and I think, what, Johnny Depp got a $15 million settlement against his ex-wife. Well, they would do anything to harm one another. There was a day that those two loved each other enough to walk down an altar, an aisle together, and swear their love and make vows to one another before God and all those who were present. I have sat through mediation for divorce, and as nasty and as ugly as it can be, I love when the mediator says, well, at some point, you love that they weren't that terrible to you because you loved them enough to marry them. So it's hard to say that they're total garbage, the worst person in the world today, when there was a time that you were close. And you see this in business relationships, where business partners that are best friends will have conflict begin and grow to the point where they hate one another. And what Jesus is saying here is he's saying, settle matters quickly. I love the language. He says, do it while you are still together on the way. This is a picture of you're walking down the road together, your friends, your partners. At that point, that's when you want to settle the conflict. When you still have a rapport, when bitterness and anger and revenge haven't entered the equation. And there will often be an opportunity. In fact, when I help people do reconciliation, that's something pastors get involved with. It's not my favorite thing unless it works, then it's amazing. If it doesn't work, it's just frustrating and time-consuming. But at the root of many of these conflicts, especially early on when they're still together in the way, the party who's at fault understands that they're at fault. They know they did something wrong. Even in the Johnny Depp Amber Heard trial, Johnny Depp confessed before the entire jury that he was a drug addict, that he was not a nice person, that he was an alcoholic. So it's not that we try and prove that we're perfect, but it goes something like this. I do something to offend my friend, my partner, my spouse. And my spouse comes back and says, that's like the worst thing that's ever happened. And I'm like, well, it's not the worst thing that's ever happened. And their remedy to that pain is far larger than maybe what I'm willing to spend. And that's when that division starts to grow and build. And what Jesus is saying here is he's saying, no matter what you think, it's always going to be a lot less costly. And here, finances are part of the equation. But more than that, emotions and spiritually, it's a lot less costly for you to just pay the price, to just say, I'm sorry, to take whatever it is while you're still together on the way, than to watch things escalate as they would end up in court. I know this a little bit from experience because I was in a car accident, many of you know, a long time ago it seems now. And the insurance company decided all I wanted them to do was to pay my medical bills. And they said, we have an idea, we're going to not pay a third of your medical bills. I had a whole list of doctors that said this needed to happen, that I had to be in physical therapy. And everyone knows that you do things like muscle scraping because it sounds fun. But I'm going through this, and again, it was a small amount of money, but I've watched as this process has gone on. You get a lawyer, now you have to give that lawyer a third of whatever settlement you get. Which is why they say a third, because they know that if you get a lawyer and you don't get any more than you would, you'd have less than you started with. But then you start looking at, and I look at from my ask, serious questions. I look at from what I asked for in the beginning to what now is the lawyers involved, is everything. The amount starts to snowball. Because there's court fees, there's lawyer fees, there's the fact that it's taken years and years and years. The point is, if we can settle matters quickly, even if that requires humility, even if that requires us to say, you know what? I don't think this is even the right thing, but to make peace, I'm willing to sacrifice. I'm willing to humble myself. I'm willing to accept responsibility. I'm willing to make amends. Because Jesus is right. He said, do it together. Do it while you are still together on the way, or your adversary, they may hand you over to the judge, and the judge may hand you over to the officer, and then you'll be thrown into prison. And truly, I tell you, you will not get out until you pay every last penny. We dig in sometimes because we feel stubborn, because we're angry. Well, I did wrong, but they did wrong too. That's why the Beatitudes begin with this idea of blessed are those who acknowledge, who know that they are spiritually in poverty. Forgiveness is a lot easier when we realize how much we've been forgiven. If you think you're hot stuff, then you're going to be mad anytime anybody crosses you, anytime they sin against you. But if you realize that you're a sinner just like everyone else, if you realize the extent to which God's grace has been applied to your life, then it's a whole lot easier to apply that grace to the life of your brother or your sister or your mom or your dad or your son or your daughter or that neighbor who just won't mow their lawn. We've got people in our life that we get mad at. We get frustrated. But we need to apply the same grace to them that God has applied to us. Jesus gives the illustration, we're not going to go into in depth today, of the unmerciful servant. And the idea is the unmerciful servant had been forgiven. And the equivalent of our days, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of dollars. But then he goes and he has his friend shaken down for the $5 he didn't get paid back for pizza night. And the king finds out and says, whoa, I forgave you so much, and you couldn't forgive that piddly little thing. It's because of the forgiveness of God that we have the ability to reconcile, not just when things get bad, but quickly. So husbands and wives, try and be quick to forgive, quick to reconcile. Parents and children, we show the world who we are as a church by our unity. That's what Jesus prayed. That they will know that they are my church because they will love one another, that they will be united the same way that Father, Son, Holy Spirit are united, have unity and love one another. There's no unity when there's hatred. So Jesus, he raises the bar to this new form of righteousness. Let's pray together.